Chapter 18, Inspiration. Jeff, it's your band now. As a self-absorbed young person, I had no bandwidth to even recognize inspiring stories if I heard them. But by my middle adult years, I started to be able to see it. Having now lived through my own successes and failures, disappointments, professional growth, I woke up to what was going on around me. The years opened my mind. I needed personal history before I could appreciate inspiring stories. In this chapter, you'll hear 7 stories of remarkable people doing inspiring things. Ginger Graham. At the company's yearly holiday party for employees and their families, an employee came up to CEO Ginger Graham with a story so powerful, both women ended up in tears.
Well, many years ago, we had an all-company Christmas party every year, a big holiday splash, and they could bring a family member or significant other with them, and it was very dressy, and the company put on a big party to thank the employees for all they had done. And I remember one party in particular where a young woman came up to me to my table and crouched down beside me, and she had big tears rolling down her face. And she said, "I need to talk to you." And I was immediately taken back, thinking, "Oh, what happened? What's gone wrong?" And instead, she wanted to tell me that she had decided that she was going to quit working and go back to college. And she was going to get a degree because she now could see that there were so many opportunities for her that she didn't know before. You know, it was a very emotional moment for me because just looking at this bright young woman who had the courage to jump, to lose her job, to give up her income, to take a risk, and to go for more education because she knew that there were opportunities in the world to make a difference that she could take advantage of because she saw other women role models in the company.
Like you.
Well, hopefully, I was one of those lights for her.
Chris Brubeck learned about integrity from his father at a Snowbound concert. He now passes along what he learned to new musicians. He always says, "Pretend that each gig you do is at Carnegie Hall. You never know who's going to be in that audience."
Once I was working in Dave's band, we were playing right outside of Chicago. We landed at O'Hare Field, and this instant blizzard came up. And it was a horrible, horrible blizzard. And we were at the sound check, and the promoter said, "I don't know what to do. No one's going to be able to get to this concert. It's like, you know, snowing 6 inches an hour. The only people would be people that might walk to the auditorium or take a snowmobile. But do you guys want to cancel the concert?" And my dad said, because he grew up on a ranch and had a strong work ethic, "Well, I wouldn't want to disappoint the people that really made the effort to snowshoe their way to the gig." So we played the concert for 30 people. Okay, so now you wait, you know, 25 years later, one of the 30 people in the audience is now working in for Ogilvy and Mather, a big famous like ad firm, and they're doing a campaign for Oldsmobile. And the guy approaches my dad's management and says, "You know, I saw you guys do that concert. I thought it was so great that an artist cared about the people. Always made me care about you. We're doing this thing. We got Roger Moore, James Bond. We got, you know, William Shatner, Captain Kirk. And we got this thing about two generations of like, we're trying to get rid of the image that Oldsmobiles are only for old people. So to make a longer story shorter, okay, we're going to get you guys all together. And we're going to do different commercials. And the storyboard is you're playing with your sons," which we did, you know. "And it's not your father's Oldsmobile," with the name of the thing. So the punchline is, you planted the seed 25 years ago with a good deed and work ethic. It ripples through the universe and it comes back. And we all got paid thousands of dollars and given the highest, most feature-loaded, high-end car that Oldsmobile made. Each of us. And I tell kids that story, they go, "Whoa!" So it's like, that's why every gig you do, you know, you do your best. You pretend you're at Carnegie Hall. You just don't know who's the one person in the audience that is going to be the person that years up the road is in an influential position, and it's like karmic payback.
Forest Rangers, Renee Mattingly, and Liz Williamson. Several years ago, I was on a spectacular day hike in the Desolation Wilderness up near Lake Tahoe. I met these two U.S. Forest Rangers who love their work. We got to talking. I asked them, why do they do this physically demanding work? What they said was inspiring. We're here at Tamarack Lake on a beautiful August afternoon, and I have run into some forest rangers. I guess my first question would be, how in the world do you get into a line of work like this out here in the wilderness all by yourselves?
Well, you just apply, usajobs.gov.
That's not what I want to know. What's in your heart that says, this is my calling? That's what I'm interested in.
Yeah, being in nature is a really good spot for me. And I like being out here and I feel connected and I want to pass that on to people I cross on the trail or at the visitor center, really convey a sense of why we have these open, beautiful spots. And I think that passion kind of drove me to want to pursue a career in educating people about that. Last Saturday, I was at Heavenly and we were doing a walk with a ranger and there was this 10-year-old kid on the trail and he really wanted to know a lot about, you know, the trees and the animals and where we were. And when we were leaving, you know, I quizzed him on all the things and he actually remembered. And it felt like I actually like got through to someone and younger. And it was
You
really
felt
awesome.
Like you made a difference.
Yeah, exactly. So
that must have
it
been,
was really nice.
Must have been satisfying.
Yeah, it was really nice.
Desolation Wilderness is unique. People come from all over the world to see it. So yeah, just being able to be out here every day is a gift, and I love Tahoe. I love the climate here. I love the scenery, and yeah, same with the people. It's really awesome to see all the people out and be able to tell them about my favorite spots or recommend places for them, and yeah.
Whenever. What's the best experience you've had so far as a ranger?
Well, actually, a couple weeks ago, my partner Sam and I were out here cutting a log. And we use a crosscut saw because you can't have mechanized tools out here in the wilderness. So no chainsaws, no bicycles, anything like that. So we have this huge crosscut saw and we're on the PCT and we're cutting this huge log. And it took us like 4 hours because there were so many people passing by. Like we talked to over 100 people, but people were just really excited. Like so many families were stopping and the kids all want to ask us questions and they were taking videos. And her and I are both females too. So that was even more novel that these two girls are out in the wilderness, like cutting this tree all by themselves. And it's not what people expect. And it's totally doable. Anybody could do it, but it kind of catches people off guard. And so for that, you know, and then just every person that wanted to stop, it was an opportunity to educate them and tell them how cool it is in this special area, why we can only use these primitive tools. And so it just opened up a lot of opportunities for conversation.
What's your takeaway message?
Get out here.
Yeah.
Come check it out.
And protect it. And know what you're going to get yourself into if you come into these places and just, you know, leave no trace.
What do you mean by that?
Just leave no trace, respect nature, stay on the trails, be respectful of other people. You know, this is a sacred, beautiful spot.
So the banana peel I left over there, I should go get that.
Yeah. You know, just we want to leave it this way for a very long time and we want to pass it down. So just, you know, come in here with respect and love it. It's a beautiful place.
Jeff Hamilton and Woody Herman. Gene Kruba blew me away in high school, so I took drum lessons. I've had drums most of my life. Watching musical groups, I pay attention to the drummers. I have these fantasies of being up there on the stage myself. But I think in reality that train left the station many decades ago. But I can dream. By the way, my high school drum teacher, Johnny Markham, sat in one night with Charlie Parker when he played at the famous old San Francisco jazz club, the Black Hawk. I figured that gives me one bounce from jazz royalty. A couple of years ago, at the Monterey Jazz Festival, I attended an interview conversation with two drummers. One was named Jeff Hamilton. He told a story about how he got started. It brought tears to my eyes. Another example from the musical genre comes from a jazz drummer. His name is Jeff Hamilton. He told this story at the Monterey Jazz Festival a couple of years ago. And he talked about as a young man, Woody Herman hired him to be his drummer in his band. He was 24 years old. And what Woody Herman said to Jeff Hamilton, he said, Jeff, what you have to understand is that in a big band, the drummer holds it all together. It's all about the drummer. So the first time that he was playing, age 24, Carnegie Hall, curtain is closed, band is all set up,
Woody Herman comes over to Jeff, puts his hand on his shoulder, and says, "Well, Jeff, it's your band now." How would that feel? Young in life, starting out. But to have that kind of confidence put in you, phenomenal.
Sarah Cameron Sunday. I was at a birthday party for Howard Leggett, a childhood friend from Berkeley. His niece, Sarah Cameron Sunday, is a performance artist from New York City. She was also there. I had heard about her work but never met her. Out of concern that we are naive about the dangers of global warming, Sarah has launched a worldwide art project called 36.5, a durational performance with the sea. The purpose is to bring attention to this coming disaster. She travels the world to coastline cities where she stands in the ocean water through an entire tidal cycle, around 12 hours. She does not wear a wetsuit. She will not talk during these performances and only drinks water. She told me that the first time she did this, she had an almost mystical experience with the moon and the water. Her performances are videotaped and then displayed to raise public awareness of the dangers we face. When Howard told me she was there, I introduced myself and asked if I could interview her about her work. She graciously agreed. You can hear the party going on in the background.
So the project that you might have heard about is called 36.5, a durational performance with the sea. It is a work that it's an ongoing series of works that began in 2013. It began as a response to Hurricane Sandy hitting New York City. When Sandy happened, I sort of understood for the first time that we were incredibly vulnerable as a place in relationship to climate change and sea level rise. I had this realization that it was entirely possible that New York could disappear in my lifetime, that things could change so rapidly that the city as I know it might not survive. And I realized that the image that I wanted to create was an image of people who were unprepared for the water. So I wanted to...
Did it get cold? I mean, did you finally...
Yes.
So you must have been... So you probably go out there at low tide.
Yeah.
And then you wait to go all the way up and then all the way down.
Yes. Yes.
And that's how many hours?
That first time it was 12 hours and 48 minutes. That first time in Maine, there was a moment when I remember looking at the moon and thinking, just feeling very connected to the water, thinking about the water and the connections all over the world. So I collaborate with a local filmmaker, and I've had more positive response to this work than anything I've made in my life. The point is that it's a struggle and it's very challenging. It is risky, but I know that I don't want to die. So I know that if I get to a point where I am hypothermic or something, or it's a real problem, I will get pulled out. But now I know I can do it because I've done it 5 times in cold waters. So I feel like, you know, as long as I'm smart about it, it should be okay.
Willow Ray. In chapter 4 on music, we met Terry Garthwaite, who started a band in the 1970s called The Joy of Cooking. Over the years, The Joy of Cooking occasionally used a trio of backup singers called Nicholas, Glover, and Ray. A few years ago, during a musical event, Willow Ray felt faint. It turned out that she had cancer. During my interview with Terry, she tells the story of how Willow died a few months later. Willow had always wanted to produce her very own CD, but had never gotten around to it. Now, with just so little time left, Terry was able to bring together 54 people from the musical and technical communities to help fulfill Willow's dying wish. As Terry describes it, the day before she died, Willow held her completed album up, kissed it, and said, "Go do your work."
Nicholas, Glover, and Ray and I did a combo performance at 142 Throckmorton in Mill Valley. After that gig, we did another one, I think a couple months later, out in Point Reyes. But at that one, Willow started feeling faint. And it turned out she had cancer. And she died last May, which is, I have a song for her, of course. So, but that was, you know, very, it actually was a very miraculous process, because she had always wanted to make her own album. And three of us co-produced an album for her. She came into the studio in the last month of her life, sang, and we finished her album. And the day before she died, she held her album in her hand, kissed it, and said, "Go do your work." It's just a miracle to me. Amazing process. She's missed, but she's very present.
The time has come by some twist of fate. I found the need to contemplate.
Gloria Steinem. I asked Gloria Steinem what had been the best part of being identified as a leader of a worldwide movement of liberation. She said, "The stories I hear." I asked if one stood out in particular. She told me a story about a prostitute who became a lawyer. She said stories like that keep her going for months.
What comes to mind when you think about, well, boy, this is great, I feel satisfied, we're really moving in the right direction?
Well, there are moments, and they're mostly small moments, I would say. You know, somebody comes up to me in the street. It's a great gift to be recognizable as part of something that I deeply care about. I'd be crazy to think it was about me. I know it's about the movement, you know. But I get the stories sometimes. You know, they come and tell me these amazing stories. Well, here's what happened in my life because of something they associate with me, or the magazine, or just because of the idea in general. And I am the recipient of those stories. And that's enough. Any one of them is enough to keep you going for a month.
Is there one that kind of stands above the others that comes to mind quickly?
Because I was in a book autograph line, you know, for a book of mine, in a bookstore, and a woman, very elegant woman in a red suit, black woman, in, I don't know, middle age, sort of 30s, 40s. While I'm signing, she's telling me the story about how when she first read Ms. Magazine, she was in jail, in prison, for prostitution. And after she read the magazine, she wondered how come she was in jail and not the customer. So she asked for law books and was told that in that state, only men's prisons had a law library, not women's prisons. So she organized the women prisoners to get law books. And she started to help them with their child custody cases, everything that happens when you're in prison, you know, you lose your kids. And then she went to apprentice herself to a women's law firm after she got out. And she said, "And now I'm a lawyer." She said, "I thought you just might like to know." I mean, that keeps you going right there for at least a month, if not longer. And there are just tons of them, tons of them.
Summary. Gloria gets charged up by the stories she hears from people whose lives her movement has enriched. I, too, get charged up from the stories I hear. These inspirational stories are so moving. With so much negativity around us, to hear about people supporting others like Woody Herman and Ginger Graham, or finding a calling that helps solve humanity's problems, like Sarah Cameron Sunday, it can make our lives brighter and the future more hopeful. These inspirational stories create a legacy for those who live them. So, in Chapter 19, we'll hear about people's legacies and about the pride they feel about what they've done with their lives.